You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Monday, July 9th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, talking on this big Glaxo fraud settlement. Not that big, actually, sadly to say, but big relative to other fraud settlements. And the propensity of Big Pharma to fudge the truth about their products. Plaintiff's attorney, Chris Paulos. Also on the program today, let's check in and see what Mitt Romney is doing in the Hamptons. Just how much disdain the 1% has for the rest of us. Meanwhile, President Obama calls for extending only tax cuts for the first $250,000 we all make, including millionaires and those of us who are not quite millionaires. LIBOR, just a matter of time, could be the next tobacco settlement. Go back to Louisiana. Follow up on that sad story of the Louisiana legislator who didn't realize that all those voucher payments were actually going to go to Muslim schools, too. And we'll talk about the New York Police Department harassing Occupy Wall Street activists. However, be glad that you don't live in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and be glad that you don't work for the city doing stuff like putting out fires, arresting people, fixing roads, really doing anything for the city of Scranton. Because despite the fact that a county court has told the mayor of Scranton, you cannot unilaterally ignore the contract you have with city employees and change what you pay them. The mayor, Chris Daugherty, is going forward with a plan to slash the pay of 398 workers down to the federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour. This is despite the fact that a judge has said, hey, you know all those contracts we hear were so important for maintaining the bonus structure for the bankers? Well, you can't just unilaterally decide to pay your workers less. And $7.25, not exactly the kind of money you want to make if you're doing, well, really anything. We've talked in the past, if the minimum wage had been tracking inflation since 1968, it would be over $10 an hour. Even then, if you're a fireman, you got to think twice about going into that burning building if you can't feed your family. This is a function of what happens when the federal government stops providing extra funds to states and municipalities. When we talk about that stimulus, that the right-wingers like to say was $1 trillion. Remind you, it was 770 billion, some odd, half of which, well, one-third to 40% was tax cuts. And that $400 billion that remains has more or less run out. And so this is why we have seen over 650-some-odd thousand government workers on the state, federal, and municipal levels get fired. And if we had been following the same trajectory that was followed by President Bush, President Clinton, President Bush after that, President Reagan, I should say before, the number of government workers would not have declined by 600,000, would have actually risen anywhere from 2 to 3 to 1 million more government workers. Because when you have a recession, when you have a great recession like we've had, private sector cannot maintain growth. You need to grow the economy by giving more money to the states, the cities, and to cut government workers at this point. So the mayor, Chris Daugherty, has figured out, well, we can just pay them crappy wages. Don't know how that'll work out, but get used to it, folks. This is coming down the pike, as we would have said in Massachusetts. I don't know if you say that in Pennsylvania. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to plaintiff attorney Chris Paulos. Right back after this.
I turned my camera on, I cut my fingers on the waves slipping away. I turned my feelings on, you made me untouchable for life.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Pleasure to welcome to the program Chris Paulos. He is an attorney with Levin Papantonio. Full disclosure, I work with one of those guys on Ring of Fire on the weekends. And Chris, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here, Sam.
Now, what is it you guys got? You plaintiff attorneys? I mean, you're a trial lawyer, and one of the things I love about trial lawyers, in fact, the thing I love about trial lawyers, is that when you have a regulatory system that is so compromised by corporate influence, trial lawyers, plaintiff's attorneys, end up being the last firewall, as it were, to the practices of corporations to take advantage of consumers and workers. And I don't know a better instance of taking advantage of consumers than these stories about these different drug companies. Essentially, well, I don't know, how would you characterize this? Lying about their products?
Well, that's exactly it, Sam. The pharmaceutical industry and some pharmaceutical corporations have basically been blatantly lying to not only the FDA but consumers about the safety and the benefits of their drugs. And this has been going on for years. And there are certain regulations that allow trial attorneys and the Department of Justice to enforce the regulations set forth in our laws against these pharmaceutical companies when they commit these sort of egregious acts.
This is like whistleblower statutes, essentially.
Exactly. There's the Federal False Claims Act, and then a lot of states have enacted similar statutory schemes in their state statutes that allow either the Attorney General or the Department of Justice to bring a False Claims Act against pharmaceutical companies when they misbrand their drugs, when they promote drugs for uses that they are not indicated for by the FDA, or when they blatantly commit healthcare fraud by overcharging the federal government or the state government through their Medicaid and Medicare programs.
Let's talk about this GlaxoSmithKline. I guess it's a settlement. It is being hailed as the largest settlement in the history of, pharmaceutical malevolence. And we're talking about $3 billion in fines. We should start by noting that this is just a piddling amount relative to how much they made on this fraud.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That's one thing that's important to note when you look at this $3 billion settlement, and it is what the Department of Justice is calling it, the largest fraud settlement in the United States history at this point, and it covers a period of almost 15 years, a literal laundry list of drugs that GlaxoSmithKline promoted for off-label uses and also ripped off the federal government. But they paid that $3 billion fine out of their cash reserves. It was a drop in the bucket for GSK, and it'll be interesting to see if it has any punitive effect on the company. One thing
I can tell you right now, it's not going to have any more punitive effect on this company, which made $27.5 billion on the drugs in question here. $27.5 billion. It's not going to make any more punitive effect than the fact that I have to pay for broadband here in my office. It's just a cost of doing business.
That's exactly it. They set aside money in their annual projections for these sort of settlements. And what's interesting to note is that GSK's stock rose when they made the settlement. So they actually benefited from settling these cases in their pocketbooks by getting a stock increase when they announced the settlement.
Unbelievable. All right. Well, so tell us what they did. What is this off-label? I mean, we hear this quite a bit. Tell us what this off-label marketing means.
Well, off-label marketing means that a pharmaceutical company has gone out and promoted a drug for uses that it is not approved for by the Food and Drug Administration. Basically, off-label uses are uses that maybe clinically relevant. Maybe a doctor sees that a particular drug is capable of addressing some issues or complaints from a patient, but that drug has not been studied nor approved for that use. Now, a doctor can prescribe drugs off-label as long as the doctor is fully aware of the risks and benefits of that drug and has a candid conversation and gets permission from their patient to do so. However, it is illegal for a pharmaceutical company to go out and market to a doctor and tell the doctor that they can write prescriptions for this particular use of the drug because the FDA has not given them permission to do so.
This is just sort of stunning. So, in other words, they'll take Paxil or Wellbutrin go ahead.
Yeah. The laundry list of drugs that are involved, the big ones that people are going to be familiar with are Wellbutrin, Paxil, and Avandia. Wellbutrin and Paxil were off-label marketed for use in pediatric indications. Excuse me, it was not indicated for pediatric use. So what basically happened here is that Paxil was promoted to doctors to use with children, when the FDA had specifically told GSK that it should not and could not be used with children. Wellbutrin was promoted for weight loss and ADD and quitting smoking and all of these indications that it was all of these uses that it was never indicated for by the FDA. And so another thing that's interesting is this settlement, although people are hearing Wellbutrin, Paxil, and Avandia, it covers a laundry list of other drugs, and that includes Advair, Zofran, Imetrix, Lotrinex, Flovent, and Valtrex. Basically, GSK was off-label promoting all of these drugs.
So this is not like a fluke, obviously, right? I mean, they're actually going
sending white label, white paper reports, or maybe even glossy brochures saying you can use this for X, Y, and Z, and maybe not saying that, hey, you know, incidentally, sometimes this is going to cause suicidal thoughts in kids or whatever it is. I mean, it basically, they're just, I don't, it's just sort of, how do they get away with this for so long?
Well, they have come up with a playbook, and almost every pharmaceutical company that I've litigated against, GSK, Merck, Bayer, just almost every single pharmaceutical company employs the same playbook. And what they do is they, first of all, what they do is they muddy up the waters of science. In Avandia, what GSK has settled here, or is acknowledging here with this settlement, is that they withheld safety data from the FDA, and that data is important for the FDA to determine whether or not the product is safe and should be used as it's indicated. Well, they withheld that, and every company that I've dealt with has done that. And what they do is they basically cook the books. They are told that they need to conduct studies, and then when the data in those studies isn't going their way, when it looks like their drug might be more dangerous than what they've already told the FDA, they basically will massage the data or cherry-pick the data or manipulate it and then turn it over to the FDA in a favorable light. And internal documents from these companies will always show this sort of behavior.
That's what we saw with this whole Pfizer story, right? I mean, in this case we're talking Celebrex. They were sort of massaging. Does Celebrex even have any value? I mean, aside from obviously billions of dollars in sales to Pfizer, but I mean, it seems like it's basically ibuprofen, but maybe more dangerous.
Exactly, and what's frightening, Sam, is that we really won't know if Celebrex has any benefit until 2014. That's what's so egregious about Pfizer's behavior with Celebrex is that they literally play by play followed that playbook. They cherry picked data, they massaged their clinical trial data, they submitted partial data to the FDA to get the information they wanted. Meanwhile, they're making $2.5 billion in sales, and then they get caught. Manipulating data and basically appease the FDA by saying, okay, we'll release all of the data that shows our drug is safe in 2014, which just happens to be the same year that their patent on that drug expires.
I don't mean to laugh about this. This is just stunning. I mean, you read some of the emails. I mean, I guess this came out in the story's from the New York Times from a week or two ago. And you read the research chief's email sent in 2000 talking about a study they showed claiming that the Celebrex was safer on the stomach than more established drugs. He wrote, "They swallowed our story, hook, line, and sinker." I mean, I don't understand how these people. I mean, how do you live with this? I don't understand. When you get these guys up on the stand, if they end up going that far, what do they say?
Well, it's the common approach of denial, or it's taken out of context. What's interesting in the Celebrex story that you talk about in the New York Times, they even put out their public statements these documents are taken out of context, or we don't recall ever writing those documents, or I don't know exactly what I meant when I had typed that in an email. It's just they kind of dodged the question, and at a trial, we love to play that in front of the jury, but at the same time, they're taking no responsibility. And what's interesting about that article that Katie Thomas from the New York Times wrote on June 27th, and the thing to me that's the most frightening about that entire article is that, and I quote, Katie Thomas says here, "Company officials have said that the drug has demonstrated its worth and safety, and it has done so. The proof, they say, of its worth and safety is that 33 million Americans have taken it." Now, that statement basically goes to show that the pharmaceutical industry treats us as guinea pigs. I would certainly like to know that all the drugs that I take have gone through rigorous testing, that all of the data has been provided to the FDA, and I'm using it for an indicated use. And what? that one statement alone basically destroys that whole myth.
Is the problem here that we do not have complete enough regulations? Or, I mean, in other words, would more regulations help, or is it simply that these drug companies are not following the law? They're breaking the law, and when they get caught, they have a fund set aside to pay their bandwidth or whatever it is, this cost of doing business. Is the problem a weakness in the laws, or a weakness in enforcement, or both?
You know, I don't think it's a weakness in the laws. There's always a fine line that you have when you're creating a regulatory scheme. People need access to healthcare. People need access to drugs. And you don't want people to be stifled from accessing safe and effective drugs for things that they need treated. But we certainly do have an enforcement problem. We've got an incestuous, for lack of a better term, relationship between the FDA and pharmaceutical companies. They're always constantly jumping the fence. Folks who sit on the FDA advisory committees that look at the safety of these drugs are often employed or have conflicts of interest with certain pharmaceutical companies. And then also the ability of the Department of Justice and the OIG to enforce these regulations is often stifled by budget concerns and manpower. The FDA doesn't have an enforcement arm. They do not have a police department that runs around the country slapping folks in handcuffs for violating their regulations. And we do have regulations or laws like the QI-TAM and False Claims Act that allow us to enforce these sort of regulations. But the resources that the Department of Justice has are spread very thin.
Yeah, in fact, the Glaxo thing, if I understand it, was a function of Elliot Spitzer as Attorney General of New York when he was digging into this stuff. Is that right?
Yeah, it's interesting to see that this GlaxoSmithKline, this most recent settlement, was a combination of state attorney generals and U.S. attorneys from a wide array of states from across the country, as well as a cooperation amongst the FBI, the FDA, Health and Human Services, the Office of Inspector General, and the Department of Justice. So it's this, and what's interesting is Attorney General Eric Holder and Kathleen Sebelius announced what they call the HEAT program. And this is the program that they put into effect in 2009 that allows the federal government to go after healthcare fraud and use the False Claims Act and the Food and Drug and Cosmetic Act to enforce these regulations, or at least stifle instances of fraud by these corporations. And so it's a good example of that. But what's frightening is that the ability of the Department of Justice and attorney generals and U.S. attorneys to use these regulations to enforce these laws is also being attacked by tort reformers and our good buddies at ALEC and the Chamber of Commerce and the American Tort Reform Association. They are now going around the country and trying to enact model legislation such as Transparency in Private Attorney Contracting, it's called TIPAC, or PARSA, which is the Private Attorney Retention Sunshine Act. Because what happens is a lot of times these attorney generals and U.S. attorneys employ private attorneys such as myself to help them litigate these cases. And now ALEC is trying to prevent that from happening. So you'll have an attorney general's office that has got no budget to enforce these cases, but has a duty to the consumers in their jurisdiction to protect them from these sort of predatory business practices. And then now they can't even bring in a private attorney to help them, assist them to enforce these laws.
And when an attorney general brings in a private attorney like yourself, is it all based on essentially on what on are you paid via are you paid up front, or is it paid as a function of the settlement? Or
depending on the agreements that are drafted, and these agreements are. You know, open to the public, and the under state statutory schemes, attorney generals have to reveal these sort of agreements. It just depends on the nature of the litigation. Most likely, in a QI-TAM setting, it is a contingency fee. But it is the relator, the private citizen who basically rings the bells, the whistleblower, who gets a percentage of the recovery, and then attorney's fees for private attorneys comes from a percentage of that percentage itself.
Is there ever an instance where any of these people go to jail? Because it seems to me, like we're seeing also with what we see with the SEC and when the banksters commit this type of fraud and whatnot, that unless people start actually going to jail, nothing's going to change, because this just becomes a small cost of doing business. Fine, we make $28 billion, we pay out $3 billion. That's not a bad ratio. Are there instances where people go to jail? I mean, what exactly do you have to do if you are the CEO of a Glaxo or a Pfizer? What do you exactly have to do to go to jail when you're talking about basically promoting the use of your drugs, which could lead to people's deaths, will lead to obviously to higher medical costs across the country, et cetera, et cetera? What do you have to do?
You know, aside from committing blatant homicide, I don't have an answer for that, because these folks aren't going to jail, and their behavior is so egregious, and it gets worse every time you see one of these settlements. The documents that are actually revealed, the behavior, the knowledge on behalf of the folks who are working for these companies, you think these folks would go to jail. At least one person would go to jail, but I know of no instance where someone has. And that is exactly why we have such a horrible culture of recidivism in this type of behavior in the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah, I don't even know if you can call it recidivism, because it's basically just like, this is just we plan for this. This is the cost of doing business. I just get shocked by this stuff. I know you must see it on a daily basis, but it doesn't stop. It never ceases to amaze me. And I just don't understand the people who work at these companies who are willing to do this type of stuff. And I got to say that if I ever leave the show, folks should be looking for me at law school. I'll go back. I'll get my degree. This is if I had known about what you guys did 20 years ago, I probably would have never done any of this.
Yeah, well, it certainly keeps you up at night, but it also helps you get up in the morning to go out and fight the good fight when you have folks out there committing crimes, literal crimes, and you know, hurting people at the price of a few dollars per pill in their pocket.
Chris Paulos, plaintiff litigator, plaintiff lawyer with Levin Papantonio. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Mitt Romney holds a soiree in the Hamptons and forgets to tell the people attending, don't open your mouth. It seems like everybody who attended that Mitt Romney fundraiser has the same disease that Mitt Romney has. Complete lack of self-consciousness. Just a total lack of awareness in the world in which they live. Or maybe they're totally conscious of only the world in which they live. They're just not conscious of how narrow it is and what happens when people outside that bubble hear what they have to say. Oy. All right, we'll be right back after this. Everybody's coming home for lunch these days. Last night there were skinheads on my lawn. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. So Mitt Romney had a series of of fundraisers in the Hamptons this past weekend. I mean, literally a series. I don't know, $75,000 a plate, $25,000 a plate. I'm sure it was very nice. I can only imagine what the what they got in terms of food. Understand, the people who are going here are obviously the one percenters. And make no mistake about it, President Obama has his share of these as well. These people, during the 2002-2007 expansion, 65% of the total growth in the economy, 65% went to the top 1% of people. Since the 2009, or at least 2009-2010 recovery, in quotations, 93% of the growth in this country accrued in terms of money, accrued to the top 1%. Contemplate that. When you hear what a New York City donor in an unnamed car waiting to get into the, I think it's the Koch brothers' house or somebody's house, who knows? There's so many of them out there. No, it was Revlon chairman Ronald Perlman's estate. Contemplate that when you hear what she had to say, why she was there for Romney. I don't think the common person is getting it. Nobody understands why Obama is hurting them. We've got the message, but my college kid, the babysitters, the nails ladies, everybody who's got the right to vote, they don't understand what's going on. I just think if you're lower income, one, you're not as educated. Two, they don't understand how it works. They don't understand how the system works. They don't understand the impact. Now, do you think that she's saying all the benefits are accruing to me and it's wrong? Unbelievable. Sharon Zambrelli, who voted for Obama in 2008, said, "I was very disenchanted with the political process and he gave me hope. But ultimately, he's just a politician, an emperor with no clothes." All right. She said, "Would you like to hear about the fundraisers I went for Obama? Do you have an hour? All the ones in the city, it was all Wall Street. It's not helping." And so, fair enough. Obama certainly has raised his a decent amount of money from these people as well. "It's not helping the economy to pit people who are the engine of the economy against the people who rely on that engine." You see where you are, folks? You are teat suckers. Whether it's former Senator Alan Simpson, whether it's Madame Zambrelli, you people are just sucking off the benefit that these one percenters create for you. And you don't appreciate it. She goes on to say, "He's basically been biting the hand that fed him in 08. I would bet 25% of the people here were supporters of Obama in 08, and they're here now." So says a woman in the 1% of the population that received 93% of any economic growth over the past couple of years. He hasn't done enough for us. And nobody else understands how much they need us. Now, can I please roll up the window? The air conditioning is getting out. Or maybe she's just asking her driver to roll up the window. Unbelievable. Really unbelievable. And meanwhile, President Obama today, if he hasn't already, will announce or call for a one-year extension on tax cuts for the first $250,000 a person makes. We're not talking about, we're just talking about now basically on wages. We're not talking about dividend checks. We're not talking about the kind of money that Mitt Romney made by leveraging the debt of companies they take over. No, none of that. We're just talking about wages. And those tax benefits accrue to anybody who makes $250,000. If you make more than $250,000 annually, President Obama is calling for a reversion to the tax rates that we saw during the Clinton years, which would raise your tax rate from 35% to 39.6%. Remember, all of your investment income not subject to this rate. How much of a difference will this be from a historical standpoint for those people making over $250,000? Well, I'm holding a chart in my hand, which shows the marginal tax rate for married filing jointly making $250,000 a year. You won't be able to see this, but it is the tiniest of tiny bumps. Now, if you go back to the 30s, the rate was all the way down here. And then for the better part of all of our lives, the tax rate was much, much higher. The effective tax rate for the top 1% is at its lowest point by far since 1960. So subtract the fact that most rich people make their money through capital gains anyways. 1940, reports Dylan Matthews in the Washington Post, there were 25 different tax rates for income above $250,000, with the highest only applying to income above $80 million in 2011 dollars. In 1940, that rate, I think, was around about 90% for if every dollar you made over $80 million got taxed at 90%. Today, there are only two rates for income over $250,000, with families making $80 million paying the same marginal tax rate as families making $400,000. So everything you make, $400,000 to $80 million a year, still tax rate, still subject to the tax rate of someone making $400,000. I shed a tear for all of them. Boo hoo. Boo hoo. And we should also note that Obama coming out strong for this is puts him at odds with Nancy Pelosi, who said we should allow the tax rates to expire after the first $1 million that everyone earns. Everyone. And Chuck Schumer, Senator Wall Street. Senator of New York. So good news. We'll see how that plays out. This is all going to happen during the so-called lame duck session, or perhaps spilling into 2013. But this is going to be a big fight. And I suspect what we're going to see is the expiration of all the tax cuts and an attempt by the Democrats to bring in sort of new temporary tax cuts for those making either under $250,000 or under $1 million. And it's not just, I should be clarified, it's not just for people making under that. It is for the first $250,000 anyone makes or the first $1 million we make. So, ladies and gentlemen, adjust your withholding appropriately. Matt, are you on that? Just make sure that you may still have your tax cuts for the first $250,000 you make here.
Help me out. Help me out greatly.
Yes. Well, we may not be just buying lunch in the Dollar Lunch District for long. All right, folks. That is our the lesser half of our program today. You can join in all the fun that happens after I say goodbye to you by becoming a member at majority.fm. Our lowest plan starts at a mere 33 cents a day, or $10 a month if you prefer it that way. if you don't want to have to send a check in every day for 33 cents. And if you're not interested in the extra content, it is still your membership that supports the first half of the show. We don't have corporate sponsors. We don't have institutional sponsors. Membership support makes up about 90-some-odd percent of our revenue. I don't know if it's 97, 98. I can't do the math. It would take me a week to figure it out. And then I'd have to probably pay for somebody to do it. You can support the show in other ways. Of course, you can buy your Amazon junk through our Amazon link. Go to majority.fm/support the show. Somebody told me today that I should be putting that on the front page. But it's so ugly, isn't it? It's just, it junks up the front page.
It's pretty ugly.
I'm not a good businessman.
Maybe we could find a nice place for it on the front page. Maybe we could figure something out.
I don't think so. I don't like it. It just doesn't look good. Maybe we will. You can also buy a Majority Report merch. JustCoffee.coop. It's fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Organic if you want it. Get a 10% discount with the coupon code MAJORITY. You can get the Majority Report blend. Everybody gets paid fairly for that when you buy their coffee. And, of course, give us a review on iTunes. Well, you know the whole deal. Just a programming note, this week's going to be a little bit hinky. I have got to take care of a non-alarming personal matter. We'll be live tomorrow, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. We will not be live. We may have a day that we do not even have a show, but we have some good interviews for you. And join us in the better half, if you will, where we'll be turning on the air conditioning. And you can call us at 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. Got a wonderful, heartwarming story about how Rick Scott and his budget cuts may have added to a TB outbreak. It's just so wonderful. This guy's unbelievable. And, of course, you can IM me at Majority FM. I'll take your IMs and your phone calls. Got a couple more stories. Story of New York Police Department. Just the harassment. It's just... I had a dream, sort of, about it. I'll talk about that afterwards. I can barely remember my dreams. And, of course, I forgot most of it. But all right, folks, we'll see you in the better half.